open the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 29. Yeah, none of your bees will.
Okay.
This is Sandy's birthday. And the public hearing on Senate Bill 29 is in
29 years.
We're not going to have to tell many times. I asked my staff to find out when Sandy's birthday was, and she told them none of your bees were. So that's the basis of my comment here, and we have a little present for her today, and I think it's a beeswax candle.
I know I did. I did.
I'm not much of a singer, but I think I can get it started. I'm going to make her suffer through a rendition of Happy Birthday.
Oh, no.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Sandy. Happy birthday to you. I would just like to take a moment and thank my administrative staff here for the work that she's done and keeping everything going and putting up with a person as disorganized as I am and making some kind of semblance of order in our committee here. And she's new at this and has done an excellent job so far. And we're pleased with it. Miss you the very best day that you can have. Sorry for work there.
Definitely.
And with that, I'll put the public hearing on Senate Bill 29.
And I'm asking you. I like that. I could do 29 again.
I guess it's we've got two of mine in it anyway.
We'll
open a public hearing on Senate Bill 942. And, it's a work session. I can't. Work session on Senate Bill 942. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 942 is this establishes an intensive non-custodial mental health case management program, and they want the bill is requesting to create an oversight committee and that the pilot program be established in Deschutes and Lane County. The Senate Committee on Judiciary has requested this bill. We just want to take committee action on it to transfer it over to Judiciary at this time. And
does that take a motion?
I so move. Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 922 be reported out without recommendation and it will return to the President for referral to the Senate Committee on Judiciary.
Senator Duncan has moved that Senate Bill 942 be reported out without recommendation and that the bill be returned to the President for referral to the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Is there any objection or comment? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator
Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator
so ordered.
Mr. Chair, do we have permission to eat during the meeting?
I think that would be appropriate for those of you that haven't conquered you between meal appetite and it.
What?
Do you want to open the mouth or just take a minute? I don't even have to wait to gavel for that. We're going to just have an informational meeting here for a few minutes, and it's a report from the Pain and Symptoms Management Task Force. Dr. Grant Higginson from the State Health Officer and Deputy Administrator is here. He was the chair of the committee, and Senator John Dukes is here also, who was instrumental in passing the bill that provided for the task force on pain and symptoms management. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I told you I was listening to Duke on the committee last year, and not this year, I've missed her, and now 2 days in a row in committees I am, so it's nice.
Senator, the way our schedule's going, I never see you at home up on the third floor. So.
Nice to get to work with you again, Senator.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Joan Duke, State Senator from District 1, and it is a real pleasure to be here today and talk just a little bit about the Pain and Symptom Management Task Force. When we created it last session, we had a lot of hopes but didn't know exactly what happened. We brought, the idea was to bring together all sides of the pain management issue, doctors, nurses, naturopaths, dentists, board of medical examiners, insurance companies, bring everybody to the table and try to determine what the barriers were to adequate pain management and how we could overcome those barriers. I have to say that this task force has exceeded any expectations that I have. They've given a lot of themselves. It wasn't always easy, especially for some of the pain sufferers who were part of the task force to attend all of the meetings. And you have the very interesting where it comes together and where it doesn't, chronic pain and end of life pain. And it was so people really worked hard to understand each other and to come out with some recommendations, which they have, and you have those bills scheduled today. And it's a good package. They've worked hard, and I'm really pleased. I think this will take us a giant step forward in managing the pain, which is something I've come to care an awful lot about.
Thank you.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Health Officer and Deputy Administrator for the Oregon Health Division. And first, I'd like to say that I think the happy birthday today was very warmly felt by a number of people in the audience, because there are a number of members of the Chronic Pain and Symptoms Management Task Force here today. And we really appreciated the work and effort that Committee Administrator Sandy put into this effort. This report would not have come about if it wasn't for her efforts and the efforts of Ann Tweed as well. I'd like to start today with an apology for the last several days. I've been sick now, so I apologize not only for the way I sound, but also I had hoped to have a real presentation for you today, or at least a written testimony, and I don't, because I've been home sick the last couple of days. So what I'd like to do today instead is to just run you through the report that I think you have before you. And before I start on the actual report, I do want to put this into a little bit of context. The report was not commissioned, I believe, because Oregon is doing such a bad job in the way of pain and symptoms management compared to the rest of the country. When you look at how Oregon stacks up, we already do have an intractable pain law in Oregon, which really goes a long way to specify that pain should be treated adequately, whether it be for terminally ill patients or for those experiencing chronic pain. We also have a high degree, high percentage of people who are terminally ill that are in hospice programs. And because of those two things, I believe that's the reason why we're seeing that the morphine use in Oregon is like second in the country. And then the final issue is that here in Oregon, we have, again, a high percentage of people who are not dying in hospitals, who instead, at the end of their life, are spending their final days either at home or in more home-like settings. And all of those things, I think, are very good signs that we in Oregon are trying to take pain and chronic symptoms management really seriously. However, even though I think we stack up pretty well in regards to the rest of the country, there's still a lot that needs to be done. And Senator Dukes and other people in the legislature have heard now for the last several sessions that still we are not optimally treating pain and symptoms, either people with chronic pain or people with terminal pain. And consequently, last session, this task force was created to take a look at those issues, what are the current practices, what are some of the barriers for people receiving optimal pain and symptoms management. I, as the state health officer, was asked to convene that task force, and Senator Dukes also asked me if I would chair it, and so I have been the chair for the last 2 years. The first thing I'd like you to do is just to take a look at the first three pages, which are a list of the task force membership. And you'll see that it is a large group, although I don't think it's been an unwieldy group. And I certainly do am very happy with some of the work and the recommendations that have come out of the group. But I think you'll realize in looking at it that it really does represent a broad range of specialties and people. There are physicians on the group, nurses.
Excuse me.
I just wonder, you commented that a number of them are here today, and they've done a lot of work. I wonder if they might be identified.
Yes, I was.
Folks just with it know them. I don't.
And perfectly fine. And yeah, I would say myself that it was a very impressive opportunity for me to learn to be involved with it. And I apologize, too, because and I don't mean to put down anybody that had a problem, but you met on a schedule that almost caused me chronic pain trying to keep up with you because I couldn't meet in places at once, and I wasn't able to attend some of the meetings, but I had a tremendous education from this, and I have tremendous respect for the people and the knowledge that they brought to that committee, and for yourself as well in the conducting of that committee work, because it was nearly a superhuman task, and I think you did an excellent job, and I would again echo your feelings about Sandy's work with that committee, too. It was very, very valuable. So please take the time to go ahead and acknowledge.
No, it takes time, but it'd just be nice if, after all that work, at least we,
Would we have time for them to stand and hear?
Say
their name and who they represent? So could task force members, please, that are in the audience, please stand? Judge, you need to stand, too. And if you could just briefly go around and say who you are and who you represented on the task force.
I'm Chris Bassenfeld, living Northwest, and I represented the Health Insurance Association here.
I'm Dane Six. I'm from the Board of Medical Examiners. I was not an official member of the task force, but because of Kathleen Haley, who is the official member of KFU, I frequently represented her.
Good morning. I'm Margaret Carley. I represent the Oregon Health Care Association. I'm Dr. R.S.
That's good, and I appreciate it very much too, because I'm glad that they are being recognized for the hard work that they did put in. But if you look through the names, and I think you can get a feeling from the sample of people who are here that it really was a broad group of people. We had physicians, we had nurses, we had acupuncturists, naturopaths, chiropractors. We had people representing agencies like the Dental Association, Nursing Association,
Our own Joan Robinson from was there too.
She represented.
I know she's busy, and they probably wouldn't let her off from down here for that. But.
She represented the consumer perspective because she does experience chronic pain. We had other consumer representatives as well, and we also had two ex officio members who were legislators, Senator Fisher and Representative Cruz. We're both on the committee as well. And like I said, I mean, we met a number of times, I believe 18 times over the last 2 years, and I was amazed with the level of participation and interest that the group has, and really appreciated the work. As I mentioned, the task force started meeting in December of 1998, and really the first thing that we did was broke into two work groups to take a look at the two major issues that were spelled out in the law that we were to address. One was to look at the current practices so that we knew what was available in Oregon, and the second thing was to look at the barriers to receiving optimal pain and symptoms management. And it's what each work group did then was had some invited people come in and testify. These were primarily providers who were providing pain management, but some consumers as well. They were people who represented to a large degree either teaching institutions or centers that were actually providing chronic pain management. And out of that work group work, if you take a look at starting on page 4, after the background, you'll see that there's a barriers work group report and a occurrences practices work group report. And what this was the early recommendations of both of these work groups. And while not all of these turned into final recommendations, we thought that it was important to have on record what were some of the things that we were looking at. This really did form a framework for how we looked at the rest of the input we received. And that's what we did next as a task force, was that we went out to to 5 different sites to get input from the public. And committee staff worked in each one of those locations, which were Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford, and LeGrand, to get both consumers involved in those presentations and healthcare providers as well. And we had, I'm not sure what the exact number was, but we had dozens of both consumers and healthcare providers testify to us at that time. Coming out of that testimony, prior to the recommendations, I think that I'm safe in saying that we developed what I call some values and philosophies, and those start on page 9. And these are some of the things that I think really underline what we're trying to get at in the way of our recommendations. And the first thing is that pain should be defined as a condition in its own right, that we believe that pain and the suffering that it causes both the patients and their families and loved ones is something that is a significant issue that needs to be recognized as something that is important in and of itself. But the second thing, that fears that underlying a lot of the reasons why people don't get adequately treated, fear of controlled substances or addiction, or on the provider side, fear that drugs are going to be diverted. While those are important issues that need to be addressed, those are things that should not act as a barrier for patients getting adequate treatment. But the third thing is that we need to have a coordinated, multidisciplinary approach to the treatment of pain. That in addition to the physical aspect of pain, there are also emotional issues, there are spiritual issues, there are social issues, and really all of those issues need to be addressed if we're going to be addressing pain adequately. And in fact, one of the things that Roger Reeks, one of our faith community members, continually tries to impress upon us is that spiritual component of pain management is a very important piece as well. A fourth issue or value was that improved access and recognition of complementary modalities is a necessity, and this really follows up on that multidisciplinary approach. But what we need to do if we're going to treat the person as a whole person is make sure that a number of modalities are available, and unfortunately, a lot of the time, funding is available only for the physical aspect of pain, and oftentimes really only for a limited number of treatments towards the physical aspects of pain. And then the fifth and final value that we have down here is that insufficient income should not be a barrier to the adequate treatment of pain. And while this may be a little too optimistic to think that we could ever achieve that as a society we should value the reduction of suffering and should work towards making sure that does become a reality. So, given those values and philosophy, after we had input from a variety of both providers and patients and advocates, we came up with the task force recommendations, which begin on page 12. And the first task force recommendation is the creation of an Office of Chronic Pain Management. And having had some discussions since then, I'm not sure we want to be talking about offices, since that may sound too bureaucratic, but what we're really talking about here is that the task force felt that in state government there does need to be a focus on pain somewhere, that there needs to be at least one person whose primary responsibility is looking at the issue of pain and symptoms management and what we should be doing about that. And the way I see it, although there are a number of recommendations within that office, but really we're talking about two things. One is that a person who is involved, an advocate for pain and symptoms management, would be an ombudsperson for patients, that this person would be able to know what the resources are around the state and how the systems work, so that if a patient is called in having problems receiving adequate treatment, that there was a person that could help to guide them through the system. But beyond being that patient ombudsman, the person would also be a clearinghouse, a real resource information individual for not only patients and their families, but for healthcare providers as well. Because that is another thing we found out, is that not all healthcare providers are knowledgeable about the resources that are out there. So that is one piece, this advocacy piece for pain management. The second piece is that The task force has come up with a number of recommendations, some of them very specific recommendations. And another job that I would see for the Office of Chronic Pain Management or for the Pain Management Advocate would be to make sure that some of the recommendations that the task force has come up with are being followed through on and actually are being completed. And a number of those things are then spelled out within that first recommendation that we think to have regional conferences for both providers, patients, and consumer advocates is important. We think that more needs to be done in the way of research around chronic pain and symptoms management. There's a belief out there by a number of people that pain and symptoms management can be very cost effective in the healthcare setting, and those are kind of things that we think need to be researched. There was a lot of discussion around the possibility of a chronic pain management registry. This would be something that would only be effective, however, if it was something that both the patients and the providers felt was to be valuable, and this kind of thing would be something that would need a lot of work to be done on before it was implemented. And then the final thing that's mentioned in that Office of Pain Management is the idea of creating regional pain centers. And this would not be to create them de novo, but there are a number of pain centers already out there that if there was some kind of systemization and standardization of the services that they provided, we thought would be a good benefit for the people of Oregon. So those are a sample of the things that this office would be doing. And like I'm saying, it's not so much an organizational office as a real focus for pain and symptoms management within state government. The second area of recommendations, and this is on the bottom of page 13, are statutory changes. And here, while we discussed a number of issues, we came up with three recommended statutory changes. Oh, and I'm sorry, back to the Office of Pain Management. There are two bills that you're going to see before you that deal with this issue. One that is on the docket today is Senate Bill 22, which pretty much mirrors the language that comes out of the report. The second bill is Senate Bill 1141, which I believe is going to be heard next week, okay, on Monday. And that is a bill that Senator Dukes has been working with some members of the task force and some people within the Department of Human Resources. And I think that both of these bills conceptually are trying to do the same thing. There's some different wording, but like I say, I think the primary concept in both of these is to have a focus on pain management within state government. And statutory changes then, the first one that we're recommending is to amend the intractable pain law. And I mentioned that we already have an intractable pain law. This is something that was passed by the legislature either 2 years ago, four years ago, and primarily for the Board of Medical Examiners. I have to say that on this one, what we're trying to, what the task force is recommending is that the consultation requirement that every patient that is within the guidelines of the intractable pain law have a second opinion, have a consultation on their intractable pain. That some people felt that this was a barrier to pain patients receiving adequate care. Some people felt that it was confusing. Some people felt that we heard testimony that in rural areas it simply was acting as an access barrier. On the other hand, the Board of Medical Examiners contends that they feel that this is standard practice, and there were a number of people on the task force who felt that was the case as well and did not want to see it removed. So I'm saying that just to say that this is one recommendation where we did not have clear consensus, but still it was a recommendation that passed by a majority of vote and so is included in our recommendation. And that statutory change is in Bill 582. The second statutory change that we are requesting is for an extension of the task force sunset date. The task force was scheduled to sunset in December of this year, and particularly because the task force has come up with a number of recommendations task force members would like to see what happens to those and be able to have input into the management of how those recommendations are being put forward. So the task force would like to continue. We are suggesting that we be extended to the year 2003. We think that some of the things in the original bill could be changed. We don't think that we need to be as specific on how many members need to be on it, and we don't need to be as specific with how often that we meet. Also, the administration of that task force would be changed in the current bill from legislative staff to the health division, and I would just suggest that if that bill does go forward, that the administrative support be put wherever the task force is going to be housed organizationally, whether that be the health division or elsewhere. And then the third and final legislative change that we're asking for is a resolution for basically a Bill of Rights for persons with pain, and that is Senate Joint Resolution 28, which basically takes the language directly from the task force report. The third area of recommendations is in regards to improve provider and consumer education. This is something that we heard over and over and over again, that consumers, their families, healthcare providers all need better education. And that better education on the professional side really needs to be at the undergraduate level, at the graduate level, and at the continuing education level. And we did hear that a number of good things were happening. Oregon Health Sciences University, for instance, has a program where residents and where medical students have to look up a pain patient as part of their training. We've heard that a number of teaching institutions, health-related in the state of Oregon, already are addressing pain and symptoms management in their curriculum. We've heard that a number of professional organizations, the Foundation for Medical Excellence being one, is already doing a number of things around pain management. So there are some things that are going on there, but still there's a lot more that needs to be done as well. One of the things that we spent a lot of time talking about in the committee was should this be a mandate? And the committee decided that because there were a number of things going on already, because there was a lot of stated interest in organizations and agencies and institutions doing more, that at this point we did not want to mandate anything. But there are a number of suggestions for improving, for taking a look at what people are doing now, for expanding their curriculums, for expanding their offerings on continuing education, and that is one of the things that is a non-legislative recommendation that the task force is putting forward, is to get out requests to all those institutions, agencies, that they take a look at what they're currently doing, make plans for what they should be doing in the future, and to report back to the task force on a yearly basis of what their activities are.
I'm just curious, the work that you've been doing, and probably a lot of good information already available. Is this information, if I were to talk to my physician, is it a good chance that through the publication so that they're aware of what's going on now?
Chair Fisher, Senator Duncan, and it would entirely depend on your physician. Some physicians are extremely knowledgeable. Some physicians are really tied into a system where a pain center that has a multidisciplinary approach is part of that. And other physicians really are not within that system at all and have very little information. And that is one thing that we found out is that there is a huge variety of educational level and interest level between different healthcare providers.
My friends are testing, I've got this horrible thing.
And then just to finish up on education, one thing that we did hear too is that patients and their families also could benefit from education. And one of the things that we talked about in this idea of this concept about regional conferences would be to make sure that there were some parallel tracks for both professionals on one side and then consumers and their families and advocates on the other side, and that those regional conferences also have been joint tracks for those two groups that are working together.
Incidentally, along the line of the pain and symptoms issue with the medical profession, Keith hit the paper and down in Douglas County in News Review about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, about a local doctor there in Mosburg is being investigated now for his apparent lack of, or alleged lack of, be careful with the words I use here, I'm trying to dabble in the legal profession here a little bit. It's alleged that he has been a bit crass in his approach to the pain problems of some of his patients, and I believe the Board of Medical Examiners is looking into this case and in a sense, so I don't know whether this is a first for the Board of Medical Examiners or the State of Oregon, but at least this shows that there is some interest in saying that these things are dealt with in a courteous and proper manner.
Chair Fisher, yes, I'm aware of that case also, and I believe you are absolutely right that that is what is showing, and actually that is addressed in the fifth recommendation, regulatory changes, which we can go to now. That's on page five. And I just want to start out by saying that one thing that we did hear as a barrier over and over again was the Board of Medical Examiners, the Board of Medical Examiners. And I want to up front say that the Board of Medical Examiners was a very active participant in our committee meetings the entire way through. That I think that a lot of the concerns that we heard expressed by both providers and consumers was actually either misperceptions of the board's positions or feeling that the board was still where they were 10 years ago rather than where they are today. I think that the people on the committee would join me in saying that the task force has really made, that the board has really made some strides through the intractable pain law to improve chronic pain management and to get at exactly what you were saying, Senator Fisher, that not only is it important to be concerned about the overprescription of medication, but also the underprescription and the inadequate treatment of pain as well. And so some of the recommendations that we're recommending in the way of regulatory changes, one is that the Board of Medical Examiners adopt a formal policy that even states more clearly than just the intractable pain law that this is indeed the case, that two, that they really do follow up on inadequate treatment of pain as well as potential overprescription of pain as part of medical malpractice. And as you are saying, this now is starting to happen in the state of Oregon. And then the final thing under the regulatory changes is that it's not only a Board of Medical Examiners issue, it's really an issue for all regulatory boards to make sure that their policies and practices are consistent with things that we're recommending, and to make sure that all of their licensees and the people that they regulate are aware that pain and symptoms management is an important issue and one that they should be addressing in the way of continuing education. And then the final series of recommendations, and this is back to page 17, deals with improved access to the treatment of pain. And here, there's two major issues. One is the establishment of pain as a diagnosis on the Oregon Health Plan. And this is pain as a diagnosis in insurance issues in general. The way things work now, and we're using the health plan as an example, is that services are covered if they fit a certain diagnostic categorization, and the way that things are categorized is by using the international classification of diseases. And pain is not a diagnosis in and of itself. So that if you are suffering from pain, that is due to a condition that is above the line, then those pain services will be paid for. But if you are suffering the same degree of pain from a diagnosis that is below the line, then the Oregon Health Plan will not cover those services. And so one thing that the task force is recommending is that the Human Services Commission, that the Health Services Commission, which takes a look at the diagnoses and where the line will fall, that they take a look at this issue and consider adding pain outside of the ICD-9 classification as something that would be covered by the Oregon Health Plan. And that until we get to that point, that some very more limited things that they could do now is to take some of the more common chronic pain diagnoses that are currently below the line and move them above the line, and those, some of those conditions are listed at the bottom of page 17.
What is the top of the line actually now, the number?
My understanding, Senator Fisher, is that it goes from lines 1 to lines 574.
I do, in 570, so I wasn't exactly sure.
Right.
Line, so these are approximately 35 plus numbers up the line. They're not something that I'd like to be included with.
That would be next.
3 or 4 or 10 or something like that. They're still out there. Out into the future of coverage, the way things are going, if we left it up just to the normal evolutionary process to increase. I'm not sure actually if we're as high as we once were even now, so that perhaps we've descended rather than ascended in the overall process.
Chair Fisher, I believe you're right. But this whole recommendation really gets to the point of pain, that access to pain management should not, as much as possible, be related to inability to pay. That people, even if they can't pay, do deserve a adequate treatment for their pain and symptoms management. Then the other piece to the access to care is that, again, to try to improve access to palliative care, a couple of projects were mentioned. One is that the Oregon Hospice Association brought up the possibility of allowing for universal access to hospice care, and actually presented a proposal or a possible bill language to move us towards that goal. We also thought, as I mentioned, that a number of people on the task force believe that pain management can be cost-beneficial for insurers and for the Oregon Health Plan, and that it really deserves a demonstration project to see whether or not that is indeed the case. And so conceptually, those two issues, universal access to hospice care and sponsoring a demonstration project to improve access to chronic pain management, conceptually those are things that the task force agreed we would like to see move forward. However, the task force did not think that this was their primary role, and really would see that being done by, in the hospice case, by the Hospice Association and others, and on the other one, the demonstration project, by people who are researchers in this field and could actually work for gaining grant funds to do such research.
And I might point out the demonstration project bill was introduced and we'll be hearing it next week.
Mm-hmm. And that, I believe, is Senate Bill 11.
I was going to mention that Senator Duke says a few bills. You know, we felt that there were more than we could accomplish today, so we're going to concentrate on those in another session.
And so thank you very much for listening to the report, and once again I would like to thank both Candy and the task force members, and I would again like to thank the legislators who were involved, Senator Duke, for sponsoring the bill, and also for coming to a number of meetings and being actively involved, and to Senator Fisher and Representative Cruz, who were unbelievable, I believe, in the level of attendance that they made, and really showed that this was a priority issue for them as well. So thank you, and be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Dukes, maybe while you're here, we could just have you give just a brief in a nutshell how your two bills relate to the ones that we're dealing with today, so that the committee would have a little insight on it. I don't feel that I have a chance to say I want to present them in your absence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we got all of the bills drafted for the task force and looked at other things as well, a committee introduced some, I introduced some. I took a little bit different tack on the ombudsman, and in fact it is continuing to evolve as I work with Mr. Weeks from Human Resources. And I was concerned about the legislature agreeing to create an Office of Chronic Pain Management, that may not be something that we could actually move forward this session. So it's simply a little different view of how you do it, but you get to the same place in terms of what it's able to accomplish and what its missions and its goals are. And I'm actually excited about where we seem to be going with that one. The other one is two demonstration projects. As Grant said, we believe that management of pain will not only get better health care, but also reduce the cost of health care. And so we're looking and working with doctors who are treating Oregon Health Plan patients and those who believe that their patients could benefit from additional pain management would be connected with a pain management team. And that team would assess the pain and write a plan for management of that pain. And the patient remains with the doctor. You do two things. You get good pain management for that patient, and you also educate the physician as well. And then we are able to get the statistics in conversation with the commission that oversees the plan. We come to understand they will need in order to try to get, for hopefully next session, to the goal of getting pain as a diagnosis. So we need the statistics from them of showing progress, and we all realize that the Oregon Health Plan has a large number of patients that where you can, if you work with them, can get those statistics. So OMAP is over it, and the entire thing is funded with grants. If we don't get the grants, we don't do the demonstration project, so it doesn't cost the general fund or the state anything.
Chair Fisher, if I might add, on either one of these bills that's talking about an office or an advocacy position, really what we're talking about is one position. That a lot of the other things we're talking about in the way of regional conferences and in a pain management registry in regional pain centers, that those would only be funded if the person responsible for pain in state government were able to generate that funding through outside research.
I think that would be a consideration that would considerably help your cause under the present grab for our dollars. I want to again say thanks. I don't wish you any ill will, but you did a marvelous job for being sick for a couple of days ahead of time. And I hope that's not a prerequisite for you doing good jobs from now on out here, because you. If you'd have known much better, I would have been suspect. I really truly believe you lived this the last couple of years, and it shows here in your presentation, because you didn't have to have written notes to make a very, very credible presentation and a very passionate presentation. And
all of this would not have happened, Mr. Chair, had it not been for Grant's understanding and appreciation and persistence.
Yes, and he very, very deftly worked the committee so that I don't think people felt that they were cut off and didn't have a chance to speak, but he kept things moving, and that shows the accomplishments that committee did. So thank you very much. And are there questions? Yes, Senator Castillo.
I don't really have a question as much as just wanting to say thank you to you and Senator Dukes for your leadership, and Grant for your leadership on this issue, and to the members of the task force who are here. Thank you very much for your work on this. I think this is an area that and we have neglected for far too long, and I'm very happy to see that we have some legislation before us that addresses this issue, and I hope that as a state we can do a better job. So, thank you.
Thank you. I think what I'm going to do in kind of direction here, the committee, until we can have a chance to hear Senator Duke's bill, I don't think I'm going to hold a work session on Senate Bill 22, which would kind of be covering the same arena so that we have a chance to discuss those anymore in a broader way rather than making a minor decision and then a major decision or possibly conflicting decisions or one that would build on the other one. Rather, I think we could work it out to where we have one as satisfactory situation as we can here, and I don't think anybody on the committee would worry too much about the authorship of the bill as long as we accomplish something on that. So I would like to kind of keep those two items together, and then on the rest of them, you know, kind of work along with them, because I'm not sure, do you feel that your other bill on the project would be harmed or helped or anything by the other?
Perhaps helps, because the more you understand pain management, the better you understand what we're trying to accomplish.
What I wanted to do is just make committee time as convenient as we could, and treat the subjects in as good a manner as we could, and not to get started on one and go way into it and have to back up and get something else that came out. And so I wanted to make sure that I had your input and what your feelings were on the overall subject, because with all due respect to Senator Castillo, thanks for my leadership consisted of being there and getting educated, and it didn't have anything to do with operation of the committee or anything else. So,
well, Mr. Chair, that's exactly why you were appointed to that task force.
Mr. Chair, it's indicating it was for your edification because you wouldn't get in the way.
Well, probably a little bit of both. But it's, you know, this is something I've always said, you know, even though I've had kind of a varied career and an opportunity to learn a little bit about a lot of different subjects, there's nothing that makes you feel like you have less knowledge than when a professional group comes together with an idea that they've worked on for years and you've just been on the fringes of it and you're left kind of in the saddle to make the decisions and don't really have the background to draw on. And knowing that folks always have their little built-in reasons for their positions and their professions and things like that, it's very, very difficult to be the decision maker ultimately on something that you provided. And I thought that that was one thing that really you did in that committee, was to keep out as much as you could without actually, being dictatorial in the process, to keep that committee workable and toward a goal where everybody was being considered and all the opinions were being considered, and yet they were progressing steadily forward to a culmination of a goal. And I hope I learned a little something about running the committee in the process.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? This is not a facetious question. Serve on the committee and learn what you learned. Do you think it's had the impact, let's say, making you a better nursing home director?
Absolutely, because we've been frustrated through the years, and I can just tell you point blank, elderly resident who's able to walk and live right next to the shopping center, and through the years as we had, we don't have that as much anymore, but we had a lot of folks years ago, because of the lack of community-based care, that could walk down to the admissions center. And I personally found one of the residents that walked down there, and even while I was working, had fallen and broken his hip on the way back. And it was a particularly messy fracture, and in those days we didn't have the knowledge medically that we have of rebuilding those fractures. And we struggled and did the best we could under the circumstances that we dealt with in those days, but it's indelibly impressed upon my mind the pain that the gentleman suffered in the process, and having to be then bedridden when he really mentally wasn't needing to be bedridden. He wouldn't have been bedridden had it not been for the fall and the resultant problematic fracture. In those days, knowing and being able to know what I know now, if I know what we know now, we would have been able to give him a lot better quality of life. So, yes, majorly.
Well, the reason I asked the question was I wasn't being facetious. It's great, and as you said that again on the committee, because of that experience, you can have some impact with your colleagues across the state, above even beyond that.
I would have to say also that Ms. Farley, who is the representative of the Healthcare Association in our long-term care issues, was extremely influential in taking that out association-wise all across the state through the nursing homes. And she does a fantastic job with working with education for long-term care, not just in the nursing home, but community-based care team. So that was good.
Just wanted to ask a question. I'm really supportive too. I'm really excited about it. I understand you have a bad back and worse morphine patch. It's changed her life completely. But are there any instances where doctors have been sued because of like morphine patches or whatever? It covered up another thing like the cancer growing in their body. You know, they didn't feel the pain because of the morphine.
Chair Fisher, Senator Shannon, yes, I do understand what you're asking. I'm not aware of any of those cases. But that doesn't mean that they have not happened, but I'm not aware of any.
I imagine at the time they would sign anything just to get out of the case.
Yeah, Chair Fisher, Senator Shannon, I mean, that's one thing that we heard is that pain is a tremendous motivator. And that it really does affect, you know, not only the quality of life, but the functionality of one's life, and mm-hmm. to get rid of that pain so that you can do more and be more productive and feel better about yourself is a huge motivator.
Well, you know, this is another thing that I think the committee brought out to me. You know, as a human being going through things, when I was 14, I fell off a combine and injured my back. And that's what I couldn't do a sit-up literally for a year and a half afterwards. I did not want to go to it. I was very much afraid of going. I wouldn't tell anybody. I just suffered through it. And I kept reoccurring, and finally when I was about 26 or 7, it got to the point where every time I would just move like that in the chair, it would a pain in there. It would get me going and coming. And you got gunshot. You didn't want to. And I could work hard. That was the thing. I could play hard and it would get over. I was off pouring concrete and really energized using my body and get over. But just studying in class, and I was one of those late college students, and it was the most painful thing because every time I'd shift the position or something in the chair, it'd get me, and then I wouldn't want to go back. And actually, it wasn't a constant pain. It was just that sharp stab. And I got the gunshot after a while. I knew every time I moved, in bed, it was bad too. You just sleep, you try to change position, and you get when you started to change and when you finished to change, and it would come and go. Maybe I'd have it for a week and then it'd just be gone. Unfortunately, it was solved. I had a motorcycle accident and got my bike and slid 65 feet on my billfold on my right side of my back, and I got up and it had bothered me for 6 months in that stretch, and I've never had a chance. Yeah, I don't recommend that.
That's not one of our recommendations.
It happened, and I don't to this day know what was the problem back there, because I never did want to really have anybody mess with it, but it got to the point where it wasn't that great of a pain, but you just get to where you just don't want to have that happen to you one more time. And it's a strange feeling. You look at a person, and I'm a big guy, you know, and I shouldn't be bothered by these little things and stuff, but stuff can get at you to the point where you get to where you just plain fear something, almost, that you know is going to happen to you. And like I say, I don't recommend that type of cure by any manner of means, but I hadn't thought about that for years, literally. Now, in this pain setting that we had, you start examining things, and you think of things that you've lived with at the time that help you to understand what other people are going through, but maybe you're unfortunate enough to have a motorcycle accident and get it fixed. like some goofy way or something like this. You know, I can't find a solution to that.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to amend the task force recommendations to include sliding on your wallet for 65 feet down.
Believe me, I still have that wallet. Well, nice thing about it at home in my desk.
Nice thing about being a man, I really understand pain.
Chair, Senator Duncan, exactly what we've been fighting for about 6 years as we've been trying to move pain management legislation through.
I understand. I think that my wife would save a big baby. And the worst, I think. Sometimes.
Chair Fisher, if I might just interject, I think what you are showing is how pain really can come to control people's life. And that's what we were hearing from patients, is that pain can control your life, and that's what they want to do, is figure out ways so that they can become in charge of their life again.
I've been working on this for about 6 years now, and one thing that's impressed me more than anything is first that almost everybody has a story of pain. And if it isn't they themselves, it's someone they know or some family member who has suffered a lot with it. But more than anything else, and I think what's kept me going, whether we won or lost, was the people whose lives are literally on the line, I mean, whether or not they can function. When you get someone who calls you and tells you that their doctor will only give them 2/3 of the pain medication they need, their choice is, do I suffer a little bit every day because I'm making it stretch through the month, or do I function well for 2/3 of the month? When you talk to a grandmother whose grandchildren are about to be taken away from her because the state has discovered she's on very high levels of pain medication and thinks that she's probably a drug addict at that point, but so the state wants to take over the kid, when neither of the parents are able to do that at this point, and the kids have had a stable environment, it's simply that the person who's dealing with that individual doesn't understand pain management and the results. And those things, those kinds of stories, when people call and say, I need help, pretty much what has kept me going. Because those are the folks that you can't throw away.
I have an idea.
Understand.
Maybe we should put SBS on the task force.
Mr. Chair, the thing where I was going.
Well, okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And hope you continue on your recovery here. And we didn't cause you to have a relapse today. But we do very much appreciate your testimony this morning. Let's see. I think I'll bypass. Pardon? Oh, okay. We have some people who want to testify on Senate Bill. Thank you. All right. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 22 and call Margaret Carley and Susan King and Ernest Massey.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to inform you, Senator Dukes' bill, Senate Bill 1140 and 1141, are scheduled for Monday the 19th, just because all this information will be fresh and online. And we'll see if
again, thank you, Senator Dukes, for coming down, and you're sure more than welcome to come back Monday and introduce your bill. Okay.
Good morning, Senator Fisher, Chairman, Representatives of the Committee. I'm Margaret Murphy Carley. I'm the Deputy Director and Legal Counsel for Oregon Healthcare, a WARE trade association that represents over 200 nursing facilities, assisted living, and residential care facilities. We're interested in enhancing the quality of life and the quality of care that our elderly and disabled clients receive. I served as OHCA's representative on the Task Force on Pain and Symptom Management. We support the legislative initiatives that are aimed at improving pain management of those with chronic and life-threatening illnesses. I had prepared testimony on all of the bills. Would you prefer for me to just to address 22, which I believe is the one that you have called, or to address the remaining bills at this time?
Why don't we just stick with 22 at this point in time, and then we'll get into the others as quickly as we can. It'll be a little easier for us to probably keep track of.
Thank you.
Especially if we want to review something on subject by subject rather than having to go through the whole meeting.
Great. Thank you, Senator Fisher. Senate Bill 22 creates the Office of Chronic Pain Management and an ombudsman within the Health Division. Senator Duke's Bill 1141 creates the Pain Management Ombudsman within the Department of Human Resources. Oregon Healthcare supports the creation of the Office of Chronic Pain Management and a Pain Ombudsman. This is one of the important changes that were recommended to you by the Pain and Symptom Task Force. There is a need for a point person within state government to assist people with pain problems, as well as regulatory bodies and agencies to coordinate our efforts at reducing suffering. Oregon Healthcare also realizes that this legislature is facing a very tight budget session, and they want to limit the creation of the funding of new programs. Oregon Healthcare thinks that it's essential that you improve at least the creation of a pain management ombudsman, whether it rests either within DHR or the health division. We believe that the pain management ombudsman will provide valuable advocacy services and will serve as a resource to Oregon citizens who are in pain. Thank you.
I'm Susan King with the Oregon Nurses Association. We represent 8,000 nurses in the state. I think it would be easiest to just say ditto to what Margaret has already said. We believe that the importance of Senate Bill 22 and Senate Bill 1141 is to bring the interests of the consumers and the professions closer together and provide some coordinating effort on the part of state government. As with the Oregon Healthcare Association, we believe that the outcome is what we're looking for, and how you get there is both a matter of preference and of funding. So we very much support both the office and the ombudsman, but recognize that the budget priorities may not allow for both. Nevertheless, we do support the effort and hope that we can achieve some degree of state government involvement in adequate pain management statewide at the end of this session. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson and committee members. Actually, I was here for Senate Bill 1141. I was on the legislative oversight, and I thought it was to be heard. I can't be here Monday, so I was hoping I could speak a few words on it.
I think in light of the fact that this relationship with Senate Bill 22, that's perfectly reasonable. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Ernest Delmazzo. I reside in West Lynn. I'm an injured worker and a chronic pain sufferer. I'd like to address you today concerning the need for an ombudsman office or a similar position for chronic pain sufferers. We're at an age of assembly line medicine where HMOs and MCOs would profit above the health and welfare of patients. For this reason, it is crucial for the thousands of sufferers in Oregon to have an avenue to get professional and complete advice and information. I believe this is a case of pay me now or pay me later. Informed patients will be able to make intelligent choices and reduce their reliance on other state agencies and programs. The Oregon Health Plan is reducing benefits. I believe they'll be a beneficiary. It has been calculated that if all those collecting Social Security disability were able to return to work, the cost savings would be a staggering $6 billion a year. I ask that this committee and the Oregon legislature give chronic pain sufferers the opportunity to better their lives through education. Knowledge is power. I hope all of you read the articles I submitted. They're the quality of mercy and caught in pain vicious cycle. I believe you'll come away from these much more knowledgeable to the upheaval and nightmare facing thousands of Oregonians. Unfortunately, if you're a chronic pain sufferer, it makes travel very difficult. I know of six people that wanted to be here and speak. It just simply comes down to that you cannot travel the distances. Two people on the coast, especially, who have seen their lives literally destroyed due to chronic pain. I do thank you, Chairman and committee members, and I can answer any questions you may have.
I would encourage you to have them get a written testimony. I don't care if it's handwritten, half a page on a postcard or whatever. Perhaps you could give them our fax number right now, and we would things could actually be faxed in here before Monday, and we will put their testimony in. As we work on these bills, we'll include it and make it available for our staff, for our committee members.
Well, thank you. Let them know.
And we certainly understand it's not just chronic pain. People have problems traveling around us. The state has some pretty far-reaching borders here, and when you face getting across mountain chains and snow and ice and one thing and another in the time and trying to work that in with continuing a job or an occupation or whatever the case might be, family needs, kids in school, et cetera. We certainly don't frown on anybody who's corresponding with us, and we're very happy to enter those things into testimony. So, for your future knowledge and any way that you can work with folks that you know that are having problems getting here to any of the meetings, regardless of what committee it is, whether it's mine or another one, most of their legislators have fax numbers, and whether it's just committee members, not fax number, they're very close, 503-986. 1984, and I'll be glad to furnish letters to the staff to furnish the rest of the committee members. So please have them use any means they can, even if it's a telephone call to the office or whatever it is they want to do, because we'll see that those things are passing.
Well, thank you, Chairman.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity and question.
Do you have a class number that you can
use?
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Mr. I'm 50 with the city.
Yeah.
Very, very good article.
Yeah, this is reading it. Is there anyone else that wished to comment on St. Goal 22 while we're here? Okay, I guess you don't have any further questions or folks here. Thank you so much for your time. I'll put the public hearing on Senate Bill 22 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 582. And, yes, we can have Ms. Carter stay right there. And Ted Hicks, I believe, has signed up to speak also. So welcome you up here. Go ahead, Margaret.
Thank you, Senator Fisher and members of the committee. Senate Bill 582 modifies the definition of intractable pain, but what it actually does is eliminate the requirement of consultation by a second physician. Oregon Healthcare supports this change in the intractable pain law. Many persons who testified at the Pain and Symptom Task Force public hearings believe that the required consultation by a second physician was a barrier to obtaining adequate pain relief. Waiting for the consultation may prolong the suffering. In some rural areas, it's difficult to obtain, and in addition, it provides additional financial burdens. No other medical treatment that we know of has a statutorily imposed second physician consultation requirement. Oregon Healthcare does realize the value and the benefits of having a second physician review the treatment and services and provide recommendations, but we support the removal of this requirement from the statute. Thank you.
And I would note that even though the ONE has not signed up to testify, they have made a note on their letter to us that they support the language change in this proposal, so we remember that in the record. Go ahead, Judge.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee. My name is Shane Hicks. I'm the medical director of the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners, and I wish to reflect to you the strong opposition of the board to Senate Bill 582. I'd like to give you a bit of background. As you will recall, the Legislative Assembly of 1995 had the foresight to create ORI 677-470-485, which is commonly referred to as the intractable pain law. Among other provisions, this act was designed to provide protection from the disciplinary action from the Board of Medical Examiners to physicians who prescribe or administer controlled substances in the treatment of patients with chronic pain, so long as such care was rendered in accordance with the provisions of the act. In addition to meeting the usual standard of care, this act placed two specific requirements on physicians using controlled substances to treat patients with intractable pain. One is that the physician must disclose to the patient the material risks associated with the prescribing and administration of controlled substances and assure that this notice was signed by the patient. And two, that in addition to the evaluation by the treating physician, an additional evaluation by one or more physicians specializing in the treatment of the body area, system, or organ perceived as the source of the intractable pain be performed. The board refers to this as the consultation requirement. These provisions became effective in September of 1996 and have been widely disseminated by the Board of Medical Examiners and the Oregon Medical Association subsequent to their enactment. The intractable pain law reflects very closely the recommendations of the Federation of State Medical Boards, who also promulgated guidelines for the treatment of patients with intractable pain. In 1997, as you know, the Legislative Assembly ordered the creation of the Task Force on Pain and Symptom Management. That report is brought to you today. Although this task force did have representation from the board in the person of Kathleen Haley, its executive director, and although both Ms. Haley and I testified before the task force in opposition to this particular recommendation, it was the divided but majority opinion of the task force that the so-called consultation requirement of ORS 677.470 sub 2 be repealed. This repealing language is before you now as Senate Bill 582. The Board of Medical Examiners is in substantial agreement with practically every other recommendation of the task force. At its meeting today, the board will consider, and I am sure approve, a major revision to its statement of philosophy on pain management in concert with task force recommendations. Copies of the original 1993 statement and the proposed revision appear as appendices C and D to the task force recommendations. The board also supports efforts to broaden access and increase public information on the appropriate management of tractable pain and supports the demonstration project bill on the appropriate management of intractable pain. However, the Board of Medical Examiners remains strongly opposed to SB 582. It is the opinion of the board that the original language of the Intractable Pain Act has had a substantial salutary effect on the access of Oregonians to proper and appropriate care for their intractable pain. The original language of 677.470 assures that patients with intractable pain receive the benefit of specialty consultation for that pain rather than risk being relegated to only a course of chronic opioid therapy. In many cases, other interventions for the treatment of chronic pain are far more appropriate or should be used in conjunction with chronic opioid therapy. However, patients may not have knowledge of these or gain access to them were there not to exist the requirement for consultation that is contained in the intractable pain law. Dr. Higginson mentioned this morning in his recent report that there is a wide range of physician sophistication regarding pain management ability. It is this very phenomenon that I feel requires the mandate of consultation, which would be threatened by the passage of Senate Bill 582. Senator Shannon's concerns this morning regarding the potential for powerful pain medications are well taken, in that they may mask new diseases. Although I'm not aware of this phenomenon occurring specifically, the possibility does point up the gravity of this type of therapy and the need for specialty access for these patients. In deleting the consultation requirement, the proponents of Senate Bill 582 maintain that it acts as a barrier to patients receiving appropriate controlled substance therapy. However, as the physician who sees every complaint regarding pain management and inappropriate prescribing that is received by the Board of Medical Examiners, I can assure you that the stimulus to provide appropriate consultation contained in ORS 677.470 in its current language assures far more access to appropriate management of pain for far more people than it inhibits. Passage of Senate Bill 582 would be a step backward for Oregonians in their quest for good pain management. On behalf of the Board of Medical Examiners, I urge you to respect your previous good judgment and allow the intractable pain law in its current form to continue to provide increased access to good care for all of your constituents, including those suffering from intractable pain. Thank you very much.
Yes, Senator. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I was wondering, could you explain a little bit more, just towards the end of your statement there, when you talked about that the current law, the current language assures far more access to appropriate management of pain for more people than it inhibits. Could you explain that a little bit more?
I have the unique vantage point of seeing all of the concerns expressed with medical care. They all come through my desk. And we see a number of complaints regarding chronic pain management on both sides. As the issue was raised this morning, we are seeing more complaints regarding inadequate treatment of pain. And we see complaints regarding a concern by pharmacists or by everything from caregivers, rarely the patients themselves, that there may be over-treatment. It is my opinion, and I don't have data, but nor did the task force have any hard data to support
whether the language that calls for a patient who is facing the need for chronic opioid therapy, chronic pain, pain that has existed for more than 3 months, pain that is stable or increasing as opposed to pain of an injury or of an operation or surgery that has gotten severe and is now subsiding, the potential for those people, they need to be managed before you give them the potential risk of chronic opioid therapy. And it is not high, and we know that that risk is probably in the past has been overstated and probably in the past has been over disciplined by the Board of Medical Examiners. As Dr. Higginson pointed out this morning, the board is changing in its approach to this, and there's no question that chronic opioid or narcotic, whatever word we should use, there are some subtle differences, is appropriate in many cases. However, merely placing someone on chronic opioids without investigating the other methods of pain control is not correct. And in many cases, unless a physician, perhaps a primary care physician or someone who is not well-versed in the management of chronic pain, has some impetus to say, I will get a consultation. We have seen cases where the therapy has gone on unchanged when it should have been, when other things which would have allowed that patient much more lucidity, much less dependence on chronic narcotics could have been done for them. But they weren't given that access. Now, yes, that access costs. In many cases, I've had things come to my desk that says, I can't get a consultation. I've had to do individual work, and this is where the ombudsman office would be very helpful to us in facilitating funding and facilitating access for patients to get information, but also for them to get access to consultation from people who can help them manage chronic pain on a long-term basis.
I think what we need to make sure that the committee understands here is this is not just asking for a second opinion. This is just not running you over to from Dr. X to Dr. Y.
Not walking this
way. This is going from the primary care physician to a specialist requiring a higher degree of examination, not just causing somebody to just have to go through the frustration of locating another doctor to have them agree or not agree with the particular situation. Now, I don't know how that would work where their primary contact was the specialist. Does that also then inquire that they get a second opinion from another specialist?
No. Senator Fishing, no. That is probably some language that should be addressed. We are not prepared to change the law. However, the board, interestingly enough, a member of the task force, Dr. Barbara Gilbertson, today is being sworn in as a member of the Board of Medical Examiners. And Dr. Gilbertson is a primary care physician who specializes in pain management. And this was specifically her concern. She says, I'm a specialist in this, and yet are you telling me that I have to get a consultation? And the answer, although the chronic pain law would imply that, the answer is no. The board has taken no action against a definitively managed chronic pain. I have had rheumatologists who say, I'm managing a patient and I am the highest level of care for this particular patient. I am the physician specializing in the body area, but I also happen to be the primary manager for this person's pain. The board is perfectly happy with that. It has never taken any action against someone who is considered to be a specialist in that area, and perhaps the law could be modified to make that exception.
Would you be willing to work with staff here on an amendment?
We could amend it.
Put that through and at least consider it here before.
The board has no problem with that. Unless they misconception and one of the concerns that people are.
I'm very sympathetic with the process that would delay getting the treatment, but I'm also very, very concerned that people have access to the very best opportunities of working with their situation. And let me ask you a question. Would this discourage someone from saying that they were, somebody was really suffering from chronic pain and it took them 3 weeks to get a consultation with a specialist or something like that, because I know in my own particular case, once in a while I've been referred from that doctor that I see normally, and he would like to have me go to some other doctor that knows a little more about one specific situation or another, and it oftentimes takes 3 weeks or a month to get a call. But what he does, he gives me something that takes care of the thing in the interim, but not necessarily would make be the thing that I would continue with after I see the specialist, but it gets the job done from the day-to-day basis. Now, is there anything in the law the way it states that somebody couldn't use some opioids or something like that on someone with chronic pain until the time that they could see, and thereby at least alleviating the pain in the short term while they were getting a consultation for a broader approach to their problem?
Senator Fisher, on the contrary, that's acute pain. And that's not, we're talking about people who are on and need to be on controlled substances for months and years. The short-term management, to say that the consultation requirement delays the treatment, I think is inaccurate, because any physician should treat pain. And it, as that pain becomes chronic, as the need for that pain is, becomes more clearly defined by investigation and by consultation, then it becomes chronic. Pain doesn't even become chronic for somewhere in the 3 to 6 month range.
I see what you're saying, because the law as it states now says that no relief for the cure or cure of the cause of the pain has been found after reasonable effort. So I follow what you're saying. In other words, this has been being treated and maybe being suppressed, but the cure isn't being found. Therefore, they need to go to the next step up. And I'm wondering if maybe some of the whole thing is maybe just a bit of a misunderstanding of exactly what things are, and if perhaps proper amendments could be made here and spelled out in a little plainer language might address the problem and not really change the intent of the law.
Oregon Healthcare would also support that clarification, because there was concern from the people that were at the pain center who were specialists that they had to send somebody out for a secondary consultation who had limited or less knowledge than they did to meet their second consultation requirement. So that sounds like one of a good solution. I do want to mention one other point, and I applaud the Board of Medical Examiners. They have done a wonderful job of attempting to re-educate the physician community about their change in practices. But what we heard in the public testimony was still a lingering fear that the board would discipline for use of narcotic opiates, and that the concern of the pain sufferers, which we heard repeatedly, was trying to get one physician to prescribe who feared the board was difficult, trying to get two physicians to agree who feared the board was even more possible. And so, again, I support some of the things that you're looking at, but again, the public testimony was that there was that the physicians feared the board, and that trying to get two physicians, in effect, to buck the board on this issue was very difficult, despite a lot of efforts by the board to change that impression in the physician community. The board really has changed, and we applaud the work that Judd and Kathleen have done. But I do want to say that there is still that lingering public perception that, notwithstanding the board's efforts, continues to be there, hence the requirement for deleting the second consultation requirement.
Mr. Chair, I guess one of my concerns about the it's the rural areas again. Now, the consultation can be via telephone, or does it have to be a person in the rural area going to see someone? I guess that's
Senator Fisher, Senator Duncan, that issue has certainly come up. I have an old friend, Dr. Reinhardt, who is in Wheeler, an old Army Reserve friend of mine, and he called me. He said, I've got patients in nursing homes. And the intent is to access that patient's situation. Certainly a telephone consultation is not the usual sort of consultation, but the language of the Act does not specify an in-person consultation. The entire Medical Practice Act is based on standard of care. And so if a reviewing physician said, an attempt was made by Dr. Reinhardt or a patient, perhaps in Senator Fisher acquired a nursing home in a small community, and there was only one physician there, an attempt to access care, be it by telephone or by whatever, by letter, would be looked upon by the board as an attempt to comply with this act. And that's not where the problem is lying in people who are not able to access care. It's the people who are not able to access, and no effort has been made. When a bona fide effort is made to provide the highest level of care to a patient, even if that needs to be made by telephone or letter or perhaps telemedicine, as other things are coming up, then that would represent a...
One other, Dr. Dick. Did you get a chance to read this article that the gentleman passed on to us?
No.
Oh, okay. I would just be curious if dealing with the Virginia Board of Medical Examiners removing a license for a person who has provided narcotics for a person who it's a pain control kind of thing. I guess, as I read this, it seemed to me that I don't want to take time to read it now, but it seemed to me as if we're alleviating this particular problem we're talking about in the U.S. News and World Report article on the Virginia Board of Medical Examiners. And by the way, I also have dealt with all due respect to the press and everything, there's sometimes other sides to the story, too. Yes, I was just going to I'm curious to hear that. Not enough. Yeah.
Senator Duncan, I can appreciate that. It's amazing. We don't look at numbers so much anymore, and that's one of the things the board has changed. The fact that some patient may be on 2 grams of morphine an hour, that's what they need. That's what they need. I mean, the amounts. We are concerned with amounts when perhaps it's a combined medication, that there's some morphine or there's some codeine and some Tylenol in it, and you're giving enough Tylenol to somebody to cause toxicity to other organs, and that's a sort of educational process. When we do have these problems, when we do come into people who are prescribing inappropriately, not so much in volume or amount, but the wrong drug or with tunnel vision on, the board looks almost exclusively to educating those physicians as opposed to disciplining them. Now, unfortunately, physicians consider, anytime the board steps in asking them to do something, they consider that discipline, and it's very clearly a blow to your pride, and it would be a blow to my pride to think that I had to be retaught. But the board primarily re-educates us as opposed to disciplines by license actions.
Just a quick comment. I did have an opportunity to spend a very brief time with you folks one day with the Board of Medical Examiners and the review official, and I have to admit I was very impressed with the whole attitude and the whole concept of re-education and seriously concerned about physicians and how to improve the care. It was a very impressive day for me. I just wanted to pass that on to you.
Well, unfortunately, you know, this is a problem that we face, and I get criticism, and it's amazing. It's interesting to see where the criticism comes on all these corporate practice bills and things that we look at. There is a tendency, and I find it in my own way, everything from my really choice of clothes style to things that a lot of my stuff rose in my teens and back in the 50s. And just like music, I've got more of a kick out of the internet. Just in being able to order some old and find I used to hunt for 2 hours through a store to try to find a 50s CD or something like that I can enjoy, that I like to sing along with, and a quartet that I like to listen to, and different things. I can do that at home in just a minute or two on the internet and order them, and I don't have to travel miles and all this kind of stuff, so I've gotten some good out of this type of things. But I have noticed, and I've been in the healthcare arena long enough to see that it's kind of a generational stipend. And the things that we get by far more pressure to continue on in the old way, without looking at anything new from doctors that have been around for a long period of time than we do from the newer doctors. and I've seen it in Roseburg because we've had a particular situation down there that's been sparked by two particular competing hospitals in a very small town, and the problem that's created in the medical field. And about every 20 years, you make the quantum leap ahead, and it generally, you can look to the situation where you've had an influx of newer, younger doctors that have been trained in a little different emphasis. Not that their training is, you know, is less or any, in any way inferior, but it's just a continuation of the process of change. And in one case, we had a situation where two or three of the older doctors in the local area either had to retire for stroke or passed away from a heart attack or something, and one of them died in a very tragic car accident. And it happened all about the same time that we got an influx of a bunch of younger doctors. And immediately, where our osteopathic physicians had not been able to practice at all in Roseburg and had their own hospital down in Canyonville, and everyone that wanted to go to an osteopathic physician had to go to Canyonville, they proved themselves. They passed the medical boards in California when some of our local medical doctors hadn't been able to pass the board in California, and they tried. And just like that, they were all of a sudden inducted into the hospitals in Roseburg. But it took a change of the old guard, actually, to do this. And I see this in all of our, everybody trying to kind of protect a way that's gone along that they're comfortable with, that they've been involved in, and they have a tendency to forget that educational technological changes, all these kind of things, better educational qualities, expanded courses and things like this are constant change and constant flux in every field, not just the medical field. And it's very, very difficult to do this. And I see this, in a way, in this pain situation, kind of involved in that same thing. And until really we pass down a generation where they're really concentrating now on the pain, the new doctors coming in now that are having these things brought to them and training and everything else are going to be far more prepared to accept these things than the old guard that had feared the Board of Medical Examiners, that has grown up with years and years and years of worry about their license and what would happen to it, as adverse to the new generation that's taught and trained to accept that kind of thing and run with it. And I see from down the future a lot less problem with stuff like this, and that'll be another problem. So something will come up that our local new people have not been trained in, and they'll be the old guard, and so it's not something we're going to solve the problem with here, but how can we work it to the benefit of the people? And if we could get some amendments here that would assure people by the language that we could do this, that this was not to impinge upon the rights of a doctor who is the expert in the field and would not chase people all over the place, that perhaps I wouldn't have any problem with putting in the law that it could be in cases where it's not too bulky to put into the law that for rural situations where it's required huge amounts of travel or for patients with incapacitated and couldn't travel, that we could do this by letter or by other means of telecommunications. I'd be more than happy to work on that kind of thing, because I hesitate to subtract from something a higher standard. If it was just going over and saying, well, you've got to have two doctors and they're both on the same level and you just got to, you know, go through the thing for the fun of a second opinion, that's one thing. But to actually deny somebody an opportunity to have a little better chance at solving the problem rather than continuing the treatment doesn't make sense to me either. Oh, we got notice. We got a caucus at 9:45. Does that mean anything to you? I spoke about another bill here, and I think I'll take a chance on my majority leader here getting frustrated with me and continue our. Okay. Hello, brother. How many? If I could just see a show of hands. How many here wanted to testify at 11:39? Okay, we got one. How about Senate Bill 28? Okay. Let's just go close the public hearing on Senate Bill 582 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1139. We have one testifier on that, I believe.
Well, two. Okay.
come on up, Billy, while Ms. Farley's supposed to be open at the subcommittee hearing.
Right.
Oh, we got a subcommittee here. So, okay.
Yes, good morning again, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1139 extends the sunset date of the task force. It modifies the reporting responsibilities and some of the duties of the pain and symptom task force, and it would change the way we were staffed, although we greatly appreciated Sandy's staff work. We appreciate the need to move this into either human resources or the health division. So we support the extension of the task force. You will see that there was actually a large volume of recommendations related to improving education and training, and the task force would like to be able to work with the various state agencies and boards and education services to try to implement some of these changes and provide the impetus.
We're trying to figure out what we're going to do with the technical part, and I think we will work well today at the post office.
Okay,
back here because
we'll do.
It's going to have to go to Ways and Means anyway. Excuse me for interrupting your testimony. We're trying to make the most of our time here.
Thank you. So we support, actually, Senate Bill 1139.
I see Ellie that you're in support of it also, so maybe you can make your remarks as quick as possible here. And
I'm
you also were a member of our task force.
No, actually, I wasn't.
You were there, though, getting into the time.
Right, I was. And that would be probably the one thing I would like to bring up about extending the task force. There's written testimony. Sorry for grammatical errors. I don't have a secretary. There wasn't a lot of time to reread it, but you get the idea of where I'm coming from. I won't go through all that. My biggest issue with the task force and continuing is that I would hope that they would have room on the task force for the health plan consumer voice. That has not been up to this point in time. I've kind of gotten in on the track with testimony and coming to all the hearings that I can physically attend, but I think the recommendations show a lack of addressing the issues that affect people living in poverty with chronic pain, depending on rationed health care and the Oregon Health Plan. And so it's my concern that I think the task force should be extended because the job's not done. But I would like to see an opportunity for a health plan consumer advocate for the health plan, someone on the task force that could represent those consumer issues. They are slightly different. If you live in poverty, you can't afford options that you can if you're a consumer of other kinds of insurance. That's, I don't think, an issue that really got discussed and brought out. And definitely in the recommendations, some of the things that most impact health plan consumers with chronic pain weren't addressed.
It was made very plain that that was an issue, and it was drawn up in even the areas of the numerical values of the different situations were discussed. And are very evident to us. So appreciate your recommendations on that. And Dr. Higginson is still here and has heard you. And can we just get the written testimony, Ellis? I want to pass this out as quick as we can here, and we'll get the pressure on it. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1139 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1139.
Mr. Chair, I move we send Senate Bill.
Is it a dash one amendment?
Yes. I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1139.
Senator Duncan has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1139. Any further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 1139 be sent to the floor with a B-pass recommendation.
I think it doesn't have to go to Ways and Means.
Oh, what's the answer?
However, excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this fiscal that we received this morning is on the original bill with the dash one removed Legislative Administration Committee as a staffing source, shifting it over to Oregon Health Division. I'm anticipating that this will be adjusted because this is based on Legislative Administration
budget issue.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
Changed how?
That the expenditures that they're showing here is coming out of legislative administration budget. Mm-hmm. If it comes out of the Oregon Health Division budget, it may be different, thus less, maybe more. I'm just bringing it to everybody's attention that this is based on.
Either way, Mr. Chair, shouldn't it go to Ways and Means?
Well, it seems like it should because we're bypassing the fiscal office basically by an amendment which doesn't really change the expense.
Right. Can't they send it to the floor if it went there by mistake?
Sure, I move we send that we refer Senate Bill 1139 to Ways and Means with a two-pass recommendation. Okay, Senator Duncan moves that we send Senate Bill 1139 as amended with additional amendments to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, objection?
Just a comment that I'd like in the record, because I haven't had a chance to look at it as much as I maybe should have, and because we got some of this stuff just today, I think the Ways and Means trip is relevant. I don't quite understand how you can have, even though it's a small amount, $82,000 spent for two half-time people that end up being a full-time person. The task force, it says, would meet maybe 10, 12 times during a whole biennium. So you have to ask how much staffing you need if you're needing that little. And I think it deserves discussion.
So you're not for this?
No, I'm saying I'm glad it's going to Ways and Means.
Okay,
I think that they need to talk about the issue when you've got a task force that's maybe meeting 10, 12 times. You know, how much staffing do they need?
Okay, let's do it. I'm ready.
Hearing no further objections, we'll quick call the roll.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Yeah.
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye. 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 Motion carries. That will be sent to the Ways and Means. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 28. And,
I think this is
excuse me, SJR 28.
I apologize for being from the picture of you. And I would be glad to yield before if anyone else would testify. But in general, I think there's broad spread support for Senate Joint Resolution 28. It directs the Department of Human Resources, health-related boards, healthcare professional organizations, and other institutions to make every effort to support the rights of persons in pain and to widen and distribute that information. The joint resolution sets forth what we consider to be a statement of rights that persons in pain should enjoy. The resolution is intended to educate both the healthcare consumer as well as the healthcare providers in their mutual rights and responsibilities. And we ask for help in passing the
Senator Fisher,
yes,
I have a question. Is there anybody here to testify against this?
No. We have Dr. Levesque and Hillary Jenny and Susan King in support. I was going to say I would excuse and go into subcommittee for the continued hearing and excuse Senator Duncan, Senator Shannon.
You're not going to work for that?
No, I will just have to bring it back.
Cause it's not a caucus.
Yeah. I apologize for that. They didn't tell me ahead of
time. Actually, we're supposed to be on the floor at 10 today.
So I understand that, and I was shooting for that and think we would have made it, but...
So this is not as far as the idea of the
start. Is there going to be further discussion about SJR 28? Or? Well, just you're signing up here in support, so as representing our from Oahu, so...
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, but I would just ask you to make your comments as short. Now, Jenny can come forward, and Susan King also. Do you want to move it?
Just pass it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
We're ready to do it.
Before I close the public hearing, I'm going to...
You got a good thing going. Take it while you can.
Support. This is also, did Dr. Levesque, do you have paper to turn in, turn it in, we'll put it with the record, but we're going to close the public hearing on SJR 28, work session on SJR 28. Any further discussion?
I move
I move FCR 28 be sent to the floor of the past recommendation.
Well, we have two-thirds motions here to you think what you
I didn't see it.
I'll give Senator Shannon a let's move that FCR 28 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, the clerk call the roll. Senator Shannon, are you okay this time?
I'd like to.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Jones?
Aye.
Senator
Ms. Orr Pickle?
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Aye.
I'm going to ask one question.
Yeah.
Do you think we should have Duke since it's the first one out of all of her work, or should I do it?
If she would like to, that would be fine. If she doesn't, I'll so note that we'll offer Senator Duke the opportunity to carry this bill, and if she doesn't wish to, we'll have Senator Shannon do it. Hereby close the or the work session on SCR 28 and close the hearing on Health and Human Services and Senate.